Well, good evening. Welcome to our Wednesday night study here at Shepherd of the Hills. We are beginning a new study this evening, and a couple people requested this one over the past few months, but the book of Proverbs, if you want to turn there, also written by Solomon, another book kind of wisdom, also a book of poetry. We're going to talk all about that here in just a minute, but the book of Proverbs, the first chapter. A reminder of our women's event this Saturday. Ladies, if you haven't signed up for that, I want to encourage you to do that. But it's a pajama party. And or is it Saturday or Friday? I can't remember. But whatever day it is, it's on the bulletin. It's on the website. And I do want to encourage you, come on out to that. It's going to be a good time. There's food, a lot of good fun, good conversation. But that's coming up. Also, we have a church-wide workday coming up in a couple of weeks. Also in the bulletin, want to encourage you to check that out. Consider if you can come out, that'd be great. If you're able to help, great. We've got a few things that we want to work on. We want to spruce up the building, want to spruce up the outside a little bit. We've got some mulch that we need to spread over at the playground. We try to do that every year or two. And this is a year we need to do it. We also have some work downstairs and some of the classrooms we're trying to do to get ready for the next school year. We have to expand the school again, and so we've got a classroom we need to work on a little bit. And so there'll be a little bit of that with demolition and just cleaning and stuff of that sort. But a lot of light work, a little bit of heavy work, not a whole lot of heavy work, but a little bit. And some yard work, some trimming of trees and shrubbery and stuff like that. So if you're able to come out for a few hours that day, it would be great. But again, that's going to be in a couple of weeks. We have our church-wide spring cleaning work day. And also, just as a reminder, our school is asking if you would be able to, if you'd pray about sponsoring a set of books for a student next year. It is $46 to sponsor one book, $184 to sponsor a whole set. And that whole set will cover their math, science, English, and history. And some of those subjects have more than one book. Some of them, it's just a thick book. But the books are out there on the table there in the lobby. There's orange envelopes out there. If you're going to use cash, then we just ask you to use one of the envelopes. And they're bright orange now. We'd written on them last week, but they're bright orange now so that we'll know exactly when we see one what it's for. So that's what that is there for. That'll be going all of April and May for anybody who would like to help us do that. But our school really is a wonderful ministry. The Lord has blessed abundantly in recent years. And we're able to offer Christian education to kids at 85, 90% less than other Christian schools. In fact, we just price compared with one school recently. Their tuition runs somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 to $11,000 a year for a single student. Our tuition for a single student runs in the neighborhood of $1,300 a year. And so just to give you a sense of what we're talking about, there's not a lot of fat in that. You know, we pay the teachers, we pay the aides that are there, we pay for the supplies, and we lean very heavily on anybody who can partner with us to make that so accessible. Because $1,300 for a whole school year, you can understand, that's, we're talking like $145 a month. And so that really is a great deal, considering that's four school days. That is all the subjects, in addition to extracurricular things that we're able to offer, like music, sign language, culinary, phys ed, health and safety. We do things with fire safety. We do things, I don't know if I said music, but music is in there. And so lots of things that we're able to do here because we have such wonderful people that pour their heart into it. So that's what we're behind. That's what I'm behind. I love it. The Lord has blessed it. And so if you are willing and able to at least pray about it, and if you can't give financially, that's okay. Prayer is more powerful than a dollar, because the Lord owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. You know, I have like $17 at my disposal. The Lord owns all of them. And so he can bring to bear whatever it is that he wants on the places that he needs. And so we ask for your prayers as well. And always the prayers, always the prayers. But if you're able to help support in a way that sponsors a book, also very much appreciated. But again, that is out there on the table. We are in the book of Proverbs, the book of wisdom. and chapter 1. I don't know what page that is in your Bible, but in my Bible it's page 914. I doubt it's the same for you. But where we were last time was Ecclesiastes. You just go left one and you're in Proverbs. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the evening, and we thank you, Lord, that you've allowed us to gather, that you've given us the ability, the time, the capacity, the desire, the faith. Lord, you've given us all the things that we need in order to do this task tonight of opening your word, the hard work. Lord, it is a labor of love because we could be doing anything else right now. But this is what we're here, to labor over your word, because we believe that in doing that, we're equipping ourselves for work, that we're preparing ourselves for the field, that we're building up our spiritual armor, we're sharpening our sword, because when we leave this building, Lord, we're going into the war zone. And the war zone isn't just in Iran, and it's not just in Ukraine, it's not just abroad. Lord, there is spiritual war around us all the time, and your word tells us to put on your armor so that we can withstand the schemes of the devil. So, Father, as we do that tonight, as we receive your wisdom, I pray that you would give us minds to understand it, that you would give us hearts to receive and accept it, and that you'd give us hands and feet to use it and live it as we go in Jesus' name. Amen. The United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, is one of the preeminent colleges in the world. Every single year, thousands and thousands of would-be naval officers apply and are rejected. Getting into one of the military academies is by far one of the most difficult things to do as an academic applicant. But many do, and when they do, they go through, they graduate, and they're commissioned as an ensign in the United States Navy. Throughout the 4 years that they're there, they will learn all kinds of things from ship navigation to command to battle tactics, and even customs and courtesies and history of the United States military. Well, I heard a story of a young ensign who had come out of the academy recently. And he was assigned to this brand new destroyer. And as was the custom of the day, because of his position on the bridge as the helmsman, the captain would give him the task of taking the boat out of dock and out of the harbor and out to the open sea. And so the ensign was so excited. He got up to the bridge and he started shouting orders. He started yelling at all the crew members and organizing and directing. And before you knew it, everybody was running to and fro, all with their jobs, a lot of busyness going on. And the ship had backed up and had turned around and was now headed out toward the horizon. It was a flawless launch. And it was done in record time. Well, the ensign was feeling pretty good about himself, and he was standing there on the bridge. And before long, a sailor approached him and said, "Sir, I have an urgent message from the captain." Well, the ensign was thinking, you know, yeah, I did a pretty good job. I'm surprised that I didn't hear from the captain sooner. And so the message was there, but he was interested to learn that this was actually a radio message, which he thought was a little bizarre. But he said, you know, continue, carry on. And so the sailor said, "Well, this is the message from the captain. Ensign, you have done a phenomenal job. You've gotten the ship out of harbor, safely turned around, launched into the open sea. You've done it in record time. I've never seen something more efficient. It is customary, however, to wait for the captain to be aboard before launching the vessel into the ocean. Please come back." I remember when I was a kid, we would read books called Amelia Bedelia. You might remember those. Amelia Bedelia was just a wonderful little character, and she was one of those that you couldn't help but love. Amelia Bedelia was the kind of character that would get instructions and take them so literally that she would mess everything up. And before she could be brought back, somebody would yell, "Amelia Bedelia, wait, come back. You don't have it all right yet." But she was already off. She was going to go do her thing. In one particular book, Amelia Bedelia was told by her mother, okay, Amelia, I would like you to go and dust the living room. Okay, Mom, I'm on it. Wait, but come back. I didn't tell you the rest. Well, Amelia didn't hear the instructions. So she went outside and she gathered all the dust she could from the ground and she took it into the living room and threw it all over the place and said, Mom, I dusted the living room. She said, but you missed the second half. I meant to sweep it up and to take the dust outside, not bring it back in. And so Amelia Bedelia has a lot in common with that young ensign. A lot of knowledge, but not a lot of wisdom. There are people who will live their lives that way. They're always learning. They're always gaining knowledge, but they never really arrive at an understanding. We live in a world that's filled with information. They say we're in the information age. In fact, I was reading just a little bit ago that if you took all the information, all the knowledge that has been developed and gained by humanity from the dawn of time until the year 1850, if that was represented by a 1-inch thick scale, and then you took all the knowledge gained from 1850 to 1950, well, that would be 3 inches thick. So in all of human history, up to the year 1850, a 1-inch thick measurement, but for the next 100 years, you get 3 inches. If you go from 1850 to 1950 is 3 inches. You go from 1950 to 1985. The amount of knowledge gained in those 35 years would be as tall as the Washington Monument. And we have even surpassed that yet. We live in an age where knowledge and information are all around us, always, and there's always more. There are thousands of new websites launched every single day, tens of thousands of books published every single year. There is no lack of knowledge available in the world. I also heard an interesting statistic that said an individual who's born today, by the time they're 18 years old, in the next 18 years, because of how fast knowledge is actually acquired in the world now, that 98% of everything that is known will have been known in those 18 years. And so everything up to those 18 years would only be 2% of the grand total by the time that little child is 18 years old. Just think about how fast knowledge is accumulating in the world. We live in a world filled with information. We live in a world where everywhere you go, there's something to learn. There's a new fact, a new survey, there's a new study. There's no lack of knowledge available. But what we do often have is a lack of wisdom. How do we apply that knowledge? How do we take what we've learned and use it in a way that actually makes a difference? How does it affect our life? How do we take it and not weaponize it, so to say, but make it into a tool? How do we make it into something we can utilize? How do we make it into something that is actually going to bring an effect and have an effect on everyday life? How do we take the non-physical learning exercise and turn it into something that we can measure and touch and hold and feel and weigh and buy and value? Well, that's where wisdom comes into play. Anytime a pastor is preparing a sermon, one of the most important things that he'll put together is the application. And that is how we figure out what it is that we're actually going to do with what it is we've just learned. Because after all, we don't want to study the Bible just to learn a bunch of facts and read a bunch of dead names and a bunch of ancient history. The Apostle Paul says that's knowledge that puffs up. We don't want to be filled with that. But rather, we want something that's going to help. Something we can lean on when we're in trouble, something we can remember, something that if we don't know what to do and we do this, then we're pretty well guaranteed that it won't at least get worse for us. And so that's what the book of Proverbs is all about. Excuse me. It is a book of wisdom. It's written by Solomon, and you'll remember him. He also wrote Ecclesiastes. He wrote another book called the Song of Solomon. Now, the Song of Solomon is the book of love. Ecclesiastes is the book of folly, which we just spent a number of months studying. And the book of Proverbs is all about wisdom. It's interesting because those three books, in addition to Job and the Psalms, are also considered the books of Hebrew poetry in the Old Testament. And so you'll notice as we read through Proverbs, there's this sing-song kind of pattern that develops as we read through the lines. That's not a coincidence. That's not random. That's because when Solomon wrote this, he wanted to write it in a way that was easy to remember. And one of the easiest ways to make something memorable is to make it rhyme or to give it some kind of a cadence. In sermons and public speaking, very often speakers will use something called alliteration. That's where all the letters are the same, or where all the words start with the same letter, or they end with the same letter, or they have the same amount of syllables, or there's a pattern of sentence, but one thing changes. And so it just makes it so much easier for the hearer to record that to memory, because it's got a pattern. It's something we can kind of resonate with. It sticks out for a reason. It becomes something that's very memorable. Solomon employs those very tactics here in the book of Proverbs. And so he writes it in a poetic fashion. And so we have this book of wisdom. And there's a few things to note about it as we go through. One is that it's poetic. That's definitely true. The other is the person that is written in. You'll find sometimes it's the second person, sometimes it's the third. While some have taken that as something to maybe criticize the authorship, to say, well, that doesn't match over here, and so it's probably not that Solomon wrote them both, not at all the case. In fact, most scholars will tell you that the second person writing of Solomon is almost always when he's writing of something he learned, something a teacher taught him in school. When it's third person, it's something originating from him, something he's authoring uniquely. And so we're going to see both of those, not just the things that Solomon has learned and regurgitated, but new information that has come to him by revelation of the Holy Spirit. The book of Proverbs is also a book of very high moral standings and moral standards. In fact, we're going to read some things here that seem almost impossible to do perfectly, and by and large, much of it is. None of us is going to aspire to this perfectly. None of us is going to actually be able to keep every one of these Proverbs. You come to Proverbs 31, and my wife will tell you, of all the Bible verses and passages that she's ever read, Proverbs 31 is the one that cuts her the deepest. And I'll tell you exactly why, because it speaks of a godly wife and a godly woman. And it says, an excellent wife, who can find? She's far more precious than jewels. And she says, yeah, that's good. Okay, the heart of her husband trusts her. Yeah, okay, he can trust me. And he will have no lack of gain. Yes, and she does him good and not harm all the days of her life. And she's like, I'm on board with all of that. She seeks wool and flax and works with hands. And my wife does that. She sews and she's a seamstress and she's always creating things that the kids can wear and clothing and mending clothing and things like that. And talks about she is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. But here's where it gets sticky for her. She rises while it's yet night. Some versions say early. And my wife goes, I'm done. I quit. I'm not getting up that early. But we read this, and we're going to read some things that we're going to think, that seems kind of hard. It's going to be hard for us to keep that one. And that's exactly the idea. The standard of God is perfect. We need to always remember that. Now, we're not going to achieve that in this life. The Apostle Paul even admitted to his own lament. He said, not that I have achieved or am already perfect, but I press on to make it my own. That is our goal. That's what we're aiming for. Now, we know we're not going to get there in this life, but nevertheless, it's what we're aiming for. If you aim for perfection, even coming short, you're still going to be better off than had you not tried. And so we read through the book of Proverbs, and we read God's perfect wisdom for our life. This book is filled with a lot of sayings. In fact, that's what the word proverb means. It's a saying that conveys a very specific truth in kind of a unique way. In a way that we can remember. It could be a pattern, it could be alliteration, it could be anything like that, but it conveys a specific truth. Kind of like the proverbs that we repeat on a daily basis throughout life. Things like, there's a silver lining in every cloud. Or proverbs that say, when it rains, it pours. You know, all these little sayings, don't jump in or jump in head first. Look before you leap. Every dog has its day. Sometimes it's always uphill. Every one of these is kind of catchy, but it conveys a very specific truth. It's raining cats and dogs outside. We know exactly what you're talking about. Proverbs is like that. These are sayings. These are, in a lot of ways, they seem disjointed. There is a pattern as we go through the book, but we're going to notice some of them do seem to be kind of independent, and that's because Proverbs is just that. It is a group of sayings. Now, it does follow a flow. We're going to see that as we read, but each one of these can absolutely stand on their own, and they can be taken, and they can be taken very literally in most cases. Something else to just note about the book of Proverbs. And that is, as we read, it's going to appear that we're following some kind of a chronology. And some authors, and I would say, although I wouldn't call myself an author, I would agree with the sentiment that it appears, and I can't say for sure, but it appears, that what we're reading is maybe not when Solomon sat down in one setting and just wrote out 31 chapters of wise sayings, like Grandpa on the rocking chair of the front porch. I mean, I personally think that this is probably Solomon recording things throughout the going on of his life. Because we'll notice that sometimes the same advice comes up several times. Almost as if Solomon might have forgotten his own advice to himself and had to write it down again. We're going to read a lot of Solomon talking about avoiding immoral women. Well, he had 1,000 of them in his life. I think he probably forgot that lesson a couple of times. And so it's almost like he's like, yep, I should have done that, but I'm going to write it again because whoever's going to read this, it's important that you know that this one's important. And then a few chapters later, it's like, oh, Solomon, you stepped in it again. There it is, because here comes the same advice. And so it does seem, and I think that there's scriptural and textual support for this, is that we're reading kind of like a learning curve through life. And I personally think that's very comforting because I need a learning curve in life. I'm not going to learn it all. I don't know it all. I always step in it. I have this wonderful tool in my garage. It's well used. It's the most used tool that I own. It is the tool that removes my foot from my mouth. And I use it on a weekly basis. Ask my wife. You have to repair it sometimes. It's like, well, we weren't rated for this kind of a load this week, you know? And so I need a learning curve. I need to be reminded. And as we read through the book of Proverbs, it seems that Solomon also was on a learning curve through life. But it begins as we start. The book of Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. So right away, just like we read in Ecclesiastes, Solomon introduces himself as the son of David, the king of Israel. And we need to remember that in ancient times, leadership was very often a family business. If your dad was in the ministry, guess what you were doing? You're not going to be a carpenter. You're not going to go be a merchant. You're not a fisherman. If your dad was a priest, guess what? You were a priest. That's exactly how it went. If your dad was the king, you were probably going to be a king, unless there was a civil war or an uprising or something of that nature. The reality is generational businesses and occupations and vocations were passed down through the line. Joseph famously was a carpenter, and so Jesus became a carpenter. There's nothing wrong with that. I think it's a noble thing to want to follow in the footsteps of a father or a parent, somebody that you admire. And so while some would say this sounds like nepotism, that, well, you know, David was a king and he just gave the nation to his son. Well, just understand that in ancient times, you went into the family business. And if that happened to be leading the nation of Israel, it was. If it was pastoring a church, then that's what you went and did. If it was building homes, you went and did that. If it was planting a vineyard, you went and did that. If it was sailing a ship, guess what you were going to be? You were grown up on a ship, you were there, you learned the trade, and when you were old, you got your own boat, and you went and did it. And so right away, we see Solomon carrying on the business of the family, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, the king of Israel. He says in verse 2, to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. In those three verses, we read 10 synonyms. Remember, I said this is poetic. One of the marks of Hebrew poetry is synonym use. And 10 times we just read a synonym for knowledge. He says to know, he says wisdom, instruction, understand, insight, instruction, wise, prudence, knowledge, discretion. Right away, he's painting this picture that this book is going to be all about wisdom and knowledge. The ability to apply knowledge in a way that helps. That's the definition of wisdom. And so we see here that that's going to be the major theme of the book, is how to use knowledge well. You know, a lot of people know things. There's no lack of that. Remember we said just a minute ago, there's more knowledge gained every single year there. Nowadays, almost, I think every year now, we gain more knowledge than in all the years before us. We're in the information super era. I mean, this is not even the information age. It's like a super era. More is discovered every single day. Telescopes become stronger. The James Webb Telescope that was launched by NASA a few years ago is able to look deeper into the universe than anything in history. And for the first time, we're seeing images of other celestial bodies that up until now were just blurs. But now they can see images of mountains and craters and color and all kinds of background radiation. It's amazing what kind of knowledge comes from a single picture. Or sending the Mars rover to just drive around Mars. I mean, imagine being a kid and playing with remote control cars. And your parents saying, you know, that's not ever going to be a real job one day. And then you go to NASA and they go, we got a job for you. You're going to drive a remote control car all day, but it's going to be on Mars and you're going to be here on the Earth. And that's what we're going to pay you to do. I just imagine some kid got like his dream job, okay? But nonetheless, just examining the dust and the wind and the radiation from the sun and the levels of carbon dioxide or the absence of it and the thickness of the layers of atmosphere, the gravity that's there, the fact that on Mars they weren't exactly sure what they would find, and then they land a rover and they're able to drive around and discover these things. More knowledge has been learned by that single little RC car than all the other research of Mars up until that moment. Just think about that for a minute. I was learning one time that when NASA went to the moon for the very first time, there was actually a percentage of doubt in their calculation whether they could even land on it. There was a theory, a small one, but a theory, that the moon was actually just like thousands of miles of dust. And they were worried to a degree, not a large degree, obviously, because they went and did it. But there was a concern that they might land and it would just sink all the way through to the core, if there even was one. And so there was more learned just in the landing on the moon than they had known up until that point. The point I'm making is information and knowledge is being discovered rapidly. Splitting of atoms, the study of stem cells and everything else that's going on, mapping of the human brain. Things that are happening in biology. Did you know that only 5% of the ocean living, or the living ocean creatures, have actually been discovered? They estimate 95% are yet to be found. That we haven't even charted the depths of the ocean here in this world. I mean, yes, parts of it, but not all of it. In fact, it's easier to go to space than it is to go to the bottom of the ocean. There's so much about our world we don't know, and yet there's so much we're learning every single day. Knowledge is not the issue. There's plenty of knowledge coming our direction, and plenty more to come yet. The issue is wisdom. The issue is knowing what to do with that knowledge. When scientists first learned that they could split an atom and unleash energy, the wisdom of the day said, well, maybe we ought to turn this into a bomb. Well, it turned out to maybe not be the wisest thing that we did. Maybe in hindsight, that wasn't good wisdom, because that one decision to turn that energy source into a weapon has led to countless issues internationally. There are always nuclear watches. There's the threat of nuclear war, arms races. There's a war in Iran right now to prevent a nation from achieving that very weapon that our nation developed 60, 70 years ago. And so not all knowledge is worth having, but definitely wisdom needs to come with all of it. And so how do we use it well? Knowing we can do something is only half the battle. The other half is knowing whether we should. I can poke a bear. Probably not the wisest thing to do. I can jump into a junkyard and try to outrun the dog, but probably not the wisest thing to do. And so here we read all about wisdom, and that's what this book is all about. And so the first four verses, but verse 2 through 4, those three verses, 10 times we read a synonym that talks about that. He says in verse 5, "Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance." Wisdom realizes, I don't know. In fact, one of the wisest answers anybody can ever give is, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I can act like I do. I can probably come up with some smart words that make you think I know what I'm talking about. But the wisdom of an individual can say, I don't know. I need to learn. And so he says, the wise hear and increase in learning. They recognize there's a limit to the things that they know. I personally believe that every person has something to offer, that I can learn something from everybody. I love when people are teaching me something, even if it's something I've learned before, I love hearing it from somebody else. Because maybe there's a nuance that they have that I haven't thought of yet. Maybe there's a way that they view it that I never considered. Every Tuesday morning, we have a staff meeting in the conference room. And one of the things that we do for about half the meeting, we actually go through the passage that I'm going to teach on Sunday morning. Now, by that time, I've read the passage. I'm pretty confident I know what it means. I'm fairly confident that I could come up with a message left to my own devices. But I also believe that there is safety and there's something to be said for the multitude of counselors. And so the entire staff will read that passage, and we sit down at a table, and for 45 minutes or so, we just talk about it. And I love it, because even though I've read it, even though I've read the commentaries, and I've done the hermeneutics work, and gone to the original language, and done all those things, I don't see it the way they see it. And so what I get to do is I get to hear from how the youth pastor is going to look at this. How's a counselor going to look at this? How's the women's leader going to look at this? How's the music leader going to look at this? How is someone else going to look at this? How is one of our elders going to look at this? Or a person who visits our shut-ins? Maybe they see this applying a little bit uniquely to a situation that they just were in a week ago. And so we go around this table, and the richness that comes out of that meeting is something that I have just come to cherish, and it's like a handicap if I don't have it, because then it's just my perspective. And there have been so many times, every single week, that someone brings something up, and I said, you know what? I never thought of it that way. I never saw that in there. I never would have asked that question. I never would have applied it to that circumstance. And so we go around the table. We all increase our knowledge. We increase our learning. And so he says, let the wise hear and increase learning. Recognize there's things that we just don't know. And the one who understands, obtain guidance. You understand what it is? Great. Now have the wisdom to say, I need to know how to use this thing. I understand how it works. I know that if I get into a car and I turn, well, it used to be turn the key. Now it's push the button. But you get into a car and turn the key or push the button, it's going to turn on. I understand I've got to push the brake pedal. And I've got to have the key in the vehicle, and I've got to push the button, and the thing's going to turn on. I know that if I put it into drive, and I press on the gas, and I let off the brake, that I'm going to go forward. I know how this thing is going to operate. But I need a little bit of guidance, because I promise you, the first time I got into a car and did that, even though I knew how, I wasn't wise enough to know how to apply it. And so it was a pretty rocky ride, if you were with me. Those days, I'm sure my dad remembers them well. But he tells us that, let the one who understands obtain guidance. One of the most important things we can do is learn from people who have gone there. That's why doctors who come out of medical school, they go through 4 years of undergrad, 4 years of medical school, then between 4 and 10 years of residency. They're doctors. They can prescribe medicine. They can diagnose disease. But you know what? The medical society has said there's probably nothing more dangerous in a hospital than a first-year doctor. And so let's put them with a babysitter. And let's give them a few years to practice this craft under the supervision of someone who can guide them so they actually help the patients and they get the real-world hands-on experience that they need so when they are on their own, they have the understanding to do well. And so that's Solomon's advice. He says, to understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. Proverbs 25:2. You don't have to go there because I'll just read it to you. It's one of my favorite. It says, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter and the glory of kings to search it out. God has hidden within creation all kinds of little nuggets, Easter eggs of just pure intellectual joy that we are intended to go and learn. And it is God's pleasure to do that. It's his right. I mean, he's sovereign over the world. And so we're called to grow and to learn. Even Jesus grew in wisdom and stature. And so he has hidden within creation secrets, things that we can learn of, things like electricity, things like the understanding of gravity and propulsion. And something called the Bernoulli principle. If you know Bernoulli's principle, you know exactly what it is. If you don't know, then I'll tell you. When an airplane is flying, the wing is shaped in such a way that the bottom is relatively flat and the top has a curve to it. When air travels over the top of that wing, it creates a low-pressure environment and high pressure is created underneath because the air travels at two different speeds. The air underneath goes slower than the air going over top, creating low pressure, which creates lift, Bernoulli's principle. We discovered that. And a long time before the Wright brothers, I mean, that understanding of the curvature of a wing is something you see in bird feathers. You see it in gliders, you see it in even paper airplanes have an element of that in it. And so there's a secret in there that we can learn. There's all kinds of knowledge in the world. And it is intended for us to go and to seek. Now, not all knowledge is there for us to seek out. Some knowledge we would still call forbidden fruit. Knowledge that requires us to commit immoral acts. Or knowledge that requires us to violate the sanctity of life. Knowledge that requires us to go against the command of God. When Adam and Eve were in the garden and they went to the tree of knowledge, God told them, don't eat from that tree, and yet they did. They gained knowledge, but it required sin in order to do it. And so there's not all knowledge in the world is there for us. Some of it's hidden for a reason. But there is knowledge that is intended for us to discover. And so God is telling us through Solomon that it is there for us to understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. He says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Verse 7 is the key verse to the entire book. Remember, it's all about knowledge. It's all about understanding and wisdom. And here we say that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. If we do not start from a position of fear of the Lord, and understand, when I say fear of the Lord, when Solomon says fear of the Lord, it is not intended to make us think that we're supposed to be afraid of God and that we're supposed to live in fear of him that way, to where we run away from him as Adam ran from God because he was afraid. When Jesus went to the cross, it was to provide a way back into fellowship with God so that we wouldn't have to be afraid. And so it isn't that we fear him in the sense that it keeps us away, but there is a healthy fear that exists. A healthy respect for God's reverence and his omniscience and omnipotence. The fact that he cares about how he's worshiped and how we live our life and what we do with the things that he's given us to manage. And that God will, at a certain time and place of his choosing, judge the living and the dead, and righteousness will be upheld and sin will be dealt with. The Bible says, judgment is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. That's a promise from God. It's going to happen. And so a healthy fear of God says, I'm not afraid of him. It's not keeping me away. But I respect him. And I know who he is. And I know that he's holy. And I know that he means what he says. And I know that when he writes something in his book, that he means it. He committed it to posterity so that we would read it 2,000 some years later. And so it must be something he cares a lot about if he went through all the trouble of having it written down and then preserving it through the ages. And so there should be a type of reverent respect for that thing. And that is the beginning, it says, of knowledge. If we don't start from a basis of God, then nothing else makes sense. In the book of Genesis, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, I like to remind people that when you read through the Bible, there are a lot of things that are hard to understand, some things hard to accept. You come to the story of the Red Sea, for example, and for a lot of people that's hard to accept, that God parted a body of water supernaturally so that it was suspended in midair, violating the laws of physics, because liquid takes the form of its container and doesn't suspend on its own. And so to do that violates the natural law of things. And so a lot of people have an issue with that miracle, and they'll try to explain it away in so many different ways. They'll say that, well, maybe it was not the Red Sea. Maybe it was the Reed Sea. Maybe it was a mistake in interpretive work over the years. And the writers of the Bible, the translators, it's a transpositional error, that it should be the Reed Sea, not the Red Sea. And they're close together on a map. And they'll say, well, that makes a lot more sense, because if Moses was walking through a sea of reeds, he would be pushing them aside, and somebody could look at that and say, well, he's parting the Reed Sea. Now, that might be something that somebody could argue. I mean, there is, to be completely honest and transparent, there is literary support for that interpretation. But I will tell you, if that is the case, you have a bigger miracle to deal with. Because somehow, in the Reed Sea that all of Israel could walk through in water that was knee-high, you drowned an entire Egyptian army. And so I don't know what miracle's harder to believe, that God separated the Red Sea, as it seems to be, and by the way, archaeological evidence supports that, or that Moses walked through a sea of reeds and somehow in 18 inches of water, horses were drowning. But either way, that is something people contend with. They read the story of Jonah and how he was swallowed by a fish, it says, probably a sperm whale, but nevertheless, a great fish that was able to do it. And they say, well, that's just impossible to accept, that that would happen and he would survive. It actually happened at a different time in history as well. In the 1850s, there was a British whaler who was knocked overboard. He was swallowed by a whale shark, and he survived the ordeal. The whale shark died and vomited him onto, or I'm sorry, didn't vomit him. The shark landed or beached itself onto a shore and then kind of burst open because of this large foreign body in its body, and it died. But this man came out of it. He survived the ordeal. He was bleached white from the gastric juices of the whale shark, and for the rest of his life, he kind of walked around that way. Maybe something like that happened with Jonah, because otherwise what would get a whole city to listen to this guy other than he's walking down, he looks like a ghost, and he's coming through your city? But nevertheless, people read that and they go, well, that's hard to believe. Walking on water that Jesus did, hard to believe. The virgin birth, hard to believe. But if you go back to Genesis 1 and you realize that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, if you can accept the first five words of the Bible, the first four words of the Bible, in the beginning God. Well, then everything else is pretty easy to accept, because if God was there in the beginning and cast forth everything else that we live under, then he is therefore outside the laws that govern us, and so for him to suspend the laws that he created, my kids have a bedtime. You know what? Sometimes we say, not tonight. Tonight we're staying up late. They've got a rule on snacks, and sometimes we say, you know what, tonight we're going to do something different. Now, they can't break that rule, but But we can. We were the rule givers. And God, as the rule giver of the universe, can break the rules and bend the rules as he sees fit. None of that is going to make any sense if we don't start from the position of God. And so the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. I love what Paul says in Corinthians, and I quote it often, that the natural person doesn't understand the things of the Spirit of God, that they're foolishness to him, because they're spiritually discerned. If you look around at the world today, it doesn't seem to make any sense why things are the way that they are, why the church is persecuted the way that it is, why abortion is as chronic as it is, why even in the wake of the overturning of Roe v. Wade, it is still a chronic issue in our nation. There's many who are saying, Lord, what's going on here? We look around the world and we see alliances of nations that were formerly enemies. There seems to be a lineup of nations wanting to take out Israel. We look around and we see where crime is going unpunished and where children are starving and where we have gross disparity of justice in some cases. We see racism and we see hatred. We see the attack on the family and the marriage and everything else. And if you don't understand that God is moving everything forward toward the rapture of the church so that he can bring tribulation to the world to deal with all of that, well, it doesn't make any sense at all. It looks like these random, disorganized kinds of events that just make someone scratch their head going, well, what does it all mean? Well, if you start from the Bible, you know what it means. It means what Jesus said it means. He says that in the last days, these things are going to happen. There's going to be wars and famines and storms and earthquakes and brothers rising up against one another and rumors of war. He says, but the end is not yet. These are but the beginnings of birth pangs. Well, the fear of the Lord, the respect of his word, gives us the context through which to look at life. Why am I dealing with this struggle? Well, an unbeliever would look at it and go, it doesn't make any sense. It's just not fair. A believer looks at it and says, now God's trying to say something. He's trying to accomplish something. He's doing something in my life. And so here he says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. And that is so true. Some people cannot accept truth. And often it's not even the truth that upsets them, but sometimes it's who it comes from. They might be willing to accept it if it didn't come from the Bible. Do you realize I told someone the other day for the very first time that do unto others as you would have them do unto you is a Bible verse? And they went, nuh-uh. Yeah, it really is, believe it or not. That thing you've been hearing all your life, that came from the Bible. It's amazing how when people hear that something comes from the Bible, even if it's something they had accepted as truth and good instruction and wise instruction their entire life, it's amazing how suspicious they become of it, how quickly they want to just throw it away. Oh, well, if that's in the Bible, then I don't know if I'm going to read that anymore. I'm not going to listen to that one anymore. It's interesting, though, because wisdom is wisdom is wisdom. And it doesn't matter if you're a believer or not, do unto others as you would have them do unto you is generally good advice for life. As it turns out, if you treat people well, you know what? Most of the time, they will treat you well. If you're courteous to others, you know what I've learned? Most of the time, they will be courteous to you. If you go around and you make enemies and you cut people off in traffic and, you know, you're rude to the wait staff and the service workers and you're obnoxious at the office, and you bring your lunch into the office, and it's yesterday's tuna fish salad, and you know you're eating in front of everybody. You do that kind of stuff. And it's amazing how people, just generally speaking, don't seem to have much patience for that person, which then tends to lead to a very destructive cycle where they say, well, everyone hates me, so I'm just going to do this anyway. Well, then they hate them even more, and they go, see, I told you everyone hates me. They're getting what they deserve. And it's just no way to live. As it turns out, even for non-believers, doing as you would have others do to you, doing to them, pretty good advice. It's going to do you well in life. But the fool despises wisdom The fool despises instruction. The fool will hear something and they'll go, well, you know what? I'm not going to listen to that because of the person it came from. We see that in politics all the time. It doesn't matter if you voted for the individual or not, if it's a good idea, it's just genuinely a good idea. But interesting how ideas, depending on who they come from, will either be applauded or they will be cursed. And even if, and if you follow politics enough, which I don't, but I will say I've noticed this trend, everybody has about the same ideas. You ever notice that? Everybody kind of wants to, you know, do things to appease the voters, and the lines that come out of the political camps tend to be about the same. We're going to lower your taxes. Well, they both claim that. You know, we're going to help the average worker, the average American. You know, we're going to make their tax burden easier and lighter. We're going to do something to make food cheaper and to help the school system. And we're going to do all these things. They might frame it a little bit differently, but by and large, they have a lot of the same points. But one party gets into office, and the other party will vilify everything they say until they get into office, and then in large part, it's the same stuff, but now it's a good idea. Very foolish way to live. You know what a wise person says? You know what? That's a good idea. Or, no, that's not really a good idea. I know you're on my team, but that's probably not the best thing to do. Or, you know what? I didn't vote for you. I don't agree with you over here, but, you know, you got a point here. And I think that our nation would be much better served if there was more of that happening than what we currently see. But it says the fool despises wisdom and instruction. We go into verse 8, and it kind of takes a little bit of a turn. So the first 7 chapters kind of forms a thesis of the whole book, the key verse being verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. We get into verse 8, and this is where we start to see this pattern develop of a young man going about life. Remember I said it seems like Solomon might be writing this from a position of learned experience, a learning curve as he went along through the journeys of living. Well, it seems to be that way because it's almost like he's writing to a young Solomon. If you could go back and tell your younger self anything, what would it be? If you could go back 20 years, 30 years, 40 years and tell your younger self something, what would it be? If I could go back in 20 years, you know what I would tell my younger self? Buy stock in Amazon. That's what I would tell my younger self. Buy stock in Apple. Get a whole bunch of those Bitcoin things. You know, no one thinks you're going to do anything. Buy a bunch of that, like as many as you possibly can. It's going to be worth it. I would also warn myself, yeah, I might not want to do that. You're going to feel that one later. That's going to come back to bite you, trust me. If you could go back and say anything, what would you do? Well, it seems like Solomon is writing to a younger version of himself. He's writing to us. And it's a picture of this kind of this son who's launching into life. And so it begins, hear, my son. And the word hear is an active listener. It's important to be active listeners. A lot of people listen for their turn to talk. They listen for the person to stop, take a breath, so they can interject and disagree and answer. That's what most people listen for. It's just human nature. Active listening is a skill, and there are classes that help people do it because it's so unnatural for us. We tend to listen to either confirm or to oppose, but we rarely listen to understand. That's what active listening is. It's where we listen to what the person is actually saying. We're not forming our response in our head. We're not waiting for the pause. We're not waiting for them to be done. We're not, you know, thinking about everything we've got to do this week and, oh my goodness, did I leave the coffee pot on and all this other stuff. We're listening to what they have to say. We're trying to put ourselves in their shoes to see it from their point of view. Active listening takes effort, and that's what he's calling his son to do. Hear, my son. Your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. I wish as a kid I had listened and heard my father's instruction and not forsaken my mother's teaching more often. When you're a little kid, I mean knee-high to a grasshopper kind of age, your parents know everything. Wow, really? I didn't know that. You get a little bit older and You know what? You're kind of starting to wonder if your parents understand. You get a little bit older in your teenage years. You know what? Your parents don't know anything. They can't relate. It wasn't like this when you were a kid. It's so much different now. You just don't understand. You get beyond the teenage years and into adulthood, and you realize, you know what? My parents, they weren't wrong about everything, as it turns out. You get a little bit older, you get into older adulthood, get kids, get a family. Turns out your parents knew just about everything they were telling you. And that same advice becomes advice you tell your children. And I can't tell you how many times my father would say something like, I know you're not going to believe this, but at one time I was your age. And I would always say, yeah, but they didn't have electricity then, Dad, so you don't know what this is like. But that's what kids think. There's no way the parents can relate. And so it's good advice, just a good way to preface all of this. It says, don't hear this. Listen to this. This is important. Take this to heart. Don't throw away your mother's teaching. She knows what she's talking about. Stay away from that girl. She knows girls more than anybody else. Listen to what I'm telling you. Don't do this. Do this. Stay away from that. Save a little bit of money. And so he says, hear this. For they are graceful garland for your head and pendants for your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, and so here's what we do. We go back to childhood and we're launching into adulthood. Remember, this is Solomon's learning curve. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us. We will have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Hold back your foot from their paths. For their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. One of the most difficult challenges any person, especially kids, young adults, teenagers will face is peer pressure. 10 different times here we also read about peer pressure. Remember the synonyms? My son, if sinners entice you, they say, come with us, let us lie, let us ambush, let us swallow them alive, we shall find, we shall fill, throw in your lot among us, we will have all one purse. This is peer pressure textbook style. This is the pressure to conform. Paul said in Romans, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you'll be able to, and I'm paraphrasing, but discern God's perfect will for your life. And so the Bible would tell us that peer pressure is something that we should not give in to. But the reality is it's very powerful. 10 times we hear this crowd trying to persuade this young boy to go and do this evil thing that they want. It is there, and peer pressure has always been there, and we face it at every stage of life. It's not just as kids. We're just a little bit more susceptible to it then because we want to be liked. We don't want to be the ones with no friends sitting alone at lunch or by ourselves at recess and picked last for the team. And so if it means that they're going to accept us, if it means that we'll finally be part of them, then we'll just go along with it. Peer pressure. And there is peer pressure to conform or to be trendy or to wear certain clothes or to engage in certain behaviors or to participate in an activity. Or what about the peer pressure to accept things? To just be okay with it, to just go with the flow, because after all, the majority wants it that way. There's peer pressure to buy things and to keep up with the Joneses. Every single Christmas holiday season, we get all the commercials on TV. It's like, you know what, you better go down to the jewelry store, get her the new diamond that she's gonna love for Christmas. Buy the new car because everyone's doing it. Get the new phone. And then there's always these commercials, these pictures of a group of people who are out and they're all enjoying this brand new thing. There's pressure to want to be like that group. And so right away, he starts with advice to, potentially speaking, a younger one of him. And he says, beware of this. It's going to come in all forms, the peer pressure. And the warning is, do not walk in the way with them. Paul says, what fellowship does light have with darkness? It's tempting to want to be accepted by the majority. It really is. Churches everywhere are falling to that. They're compromising. They're changing doctrine. They're changing their messages. I was just talking to a pastor here on staff today about a church that he and his family used to attend years ago. And he said that the reason that they left that church was because the pastor told him they would not speak out on anything controversial because they didn't want to ruffle anyone's feathers. And so they would sterilize the messages. And they would avoid anything that might cross the line because they don't want to alienate the giving base, is kind of how they put it. They say not everybody here is going to agree with that. And my response to that was, well, that may be true that not everyone believes that, but the position ought to be, but the church teaches that. I don't believe for a minute that every single person who attends this church believes every line of this church's statement of faith. You read through it, it's online, it's pretty extensive. It's not as extensive as some, but it's pages long. And it outlines everything we teach, and we phrase it that way. We teach this, not we believe this, because I don't know that we all do believe this, but I know this is what we teach. And so a person who might not agree is just going to have to understand that while they might not agree, I'm not here to force them to agree. That's not my role. This is the church's position, and they can disagree if they would like. I hope they don't, because I think our positions are very biblically rooted, and in our statement of faith, there's dozens of verses that support every one of them. But that being said, not everyone is always going to agree on everything, especially in a modern era like we have right now. And so the response may be, yeah, not everyone believes that, but the church believes that. The church teaches that. And so we're not going to worry about whether we're offending those who don't agree with that, because it's not our job to make everyone agree with that. This is the position that the Bible has, and so it's ours. And so the advice that Solomon gives is, look, don't have fellowship with people that are going to go a different way. There is no fellowship that light has with darkness. That line is divided very clearly. Now, we can minister, we can share, we can evangelize, we can preach, but that's a very different thing than walking in the way of sinners. I love what it says in the first chapter of Psalms. He says, and I'll try to get there if I can, but he says in Psalm chapter 1, and it's a very powerful way to start the book, but he puts it this way. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. And that's what we're called to do. And so that's the advice that Solomon is giving. There's going to be groups of people that want you to go their direction. There's going to be a lot of pressure to do that. 10 times we read about that kind of pressure. He says, don't walk in the way with them. Hold back your feet from their paths. To that I would say, from the perspective of the teenage boy who's listening to this, parents can seem like killjoys. Oh, you're just overreacting. It's not that bad. Well, it might not seem like that when you're 17. But it's amazing how certain behaviors that seem innocent can spiral very quickly. Our kids love doing things that in and of themselves don't necessarily cause harm. But as a parent, you can look at that and you can say, yes, but one wrong move, one slip, one miscalculation, and it's disaster. You want to walk on that ledge? Yeah, I mean, if you stay on the ledge, you're fine. Walking on the ledge doesn't hurt you. You know what does? Falling off the ledge. And it isn't even the fall that hurts you. You're right. It's the sudden stop that's going to get you. But that's what's going to happen the minute you trip over that twig. And so it's not worth it. Don't go that way. It's not worth the risk. And so Solomon is writing, and he's saying the same thing. For their feet run to evil. You ever met somebody like that? Their feet just run to evil. They just can't wait. They can't resist. If there's an opportunity to do something that's wrong, that's criminal, that's aberrant, that's sinful, they can't resist. You put it in front of them and they go to it. They schedule around it. They drive to it. They budget for it. They justify it. They make room in their life for it. Their feet run to these things. They make haste to shed blood. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird. But these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors. So now we have the sin of covetousness coming out of this idea of taking from others and stealing from theirs. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's possessions. You know, that's one of the Ten Commandments. And I want to be clear, that doesn't mean that you can't see something somewhere and go, you know, I really like that. I think I'm going to go and find one and buy it too. That's not covetousness. Covetousness is saying, you know, I like yours. I want yours. Covetousness was when David looked at Bathsheba, and he could have had any woman in the realm, and he said, no, but I want Uriah's. I want his wife. I want her. I don't want to go find a wife of my own. I want that one that belongs to someone else. That's covetousness, wanting someone else's. And when we want someone else's, it creates this willingness in the heart to do almost anything necessary to get it, whether it's someone's job, whether it's their money, their resources, their reputation, their trust. Whatever it is, we'll do almost anything we can. We'll break any rule. We'll flee. We'll set our feet. We'll run to evil in order to get the thing that we covet of that person. And so whatever it may be that we want, the impression that Solomon is leaving here is that there are those in the world who want someone else's. And when that happens, well, then we have the sin of covetousness. And it leads to all kinds of things. We were talking earlier about the book of James. And I love what James says about this very thing. He says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, when it has produced an action, in other words, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. And so that's the warning of Solomon. Be careful of this. Because there is such a thing as the wrong crowd. And I know every mother, her fear is that her child will fall in with the wrong crowd. And fathers warn their sons and their daughters against falling in with the wrong crowd. And so beware of the wrong crowd. Beware of the ones that are going to pressure you into doing something that God would not have for your life. Greed is like a cancer of the soul. It just eats away at you, because what it creates is this very destructive cycle where nothing is good enough. Because I have the thing that I wanted, only now that I have it, it's not good enough, and I want more. I'm greedy for more. I'm never content. I'm never satisfied. I'm never filled. It reminds us of Solomon's other instruction in Ecclesiastes. He says that God has put eternity into the hearts of people. Remember, the whole book is a book on folly. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. The stuff of the world isn't going to do it. There's an eternal hole in the hearts of every person. No amount of things are going to fill that, but they will give the impression, the illusion that they will. They're going to lure you. They're going to entice you. The desire is there. It's going to make all these promises. Just do this. Just put the needle in your arm. Just take it. Just go after it. Just go and get the bottle. Just get on the website. Just go take this thing. Sacrifice for it. Whatever it is, but when you get it, your life will be complete. You'll be happy. And you are for a minute. I mean, like a hot minute. And then it's gone. And then all of a sudden this thing doesn't do it for you anymore. You got to have the next. And the next. And the next. It is so prevalent in our world, by the way, and just as we close, it used to be that craftsmen had the best warranty in all of tools. You know why? Because they said lifetime guarantee. If you ever have a tool of Craftsman that broke, you just go back to Sears, didn't matter, no questions asked. I did it a couple times. And I broke some tools doing some things with them. Maybe I shouldn't have been, you know, using a screwdriver as a pry bar and that kind of thing. But you walk into Sears, they don't even care. Here's a new screwdriver. They pull one right off the shelf. Wonderful. Lifetime meant lifetime. There have been, in semi-recent years, litigated cases in court where lifetime has been defined. Lifetime no longer means lifetime. What does that even mean to begin with? Is it the life of the owner? Well, the courts have said no. It's the life of the item. And if it's not otherwise implied, typically the lifetime of an item is 7 years. And so lifetime guarantee, many courts have held, is not actually a lifetime. And so what has happened is we find in many manufacturing outfits, they build things for about 7 year lifespans, whether it's your dishwasher, your laundry machines, your refrigerator, your stove, even cars, furniture, TVs. Used to be they were built to last. You could fix them if they went bad. But now they're built to fail. And the reason they're built to 7 years is because studies show that that's about as long as the average consumer will live with something. After 7 years, we want a new couch, new car, get tired of this refrigerator, want a new floor, want new paint on the walls. Maybe not everybody, but by and large, the market has gone that direction. People spend tens of thousands of dollars for a brand new kitchen. You know, in 7 years, they're going, yeah, these old cabinets. Oh, I could use for a reface. Oh, I need new countertops. They're just so dated these days. You know, the kitchen that we have in our house is actually the same one it was built with. And I'll tell you what, it's tired. It really is. It needs some love. It actually needs to be put out of its misery, but it needs some love. And I think to myself, you know what? That kitchen was built well. Because our house is about 60 or 70 years old. I actually got to meet the man that built the kitchen in our house. He actually owns a cabinet shop still locally. He's still in business. And he said, yeah, we actually built all the kitchens in your neighborhood. And we had him over one time to give us a quote on a new one. And he said, you know, he goes, yeah, I agree. Probably it's time. But I built this kitchen, and he says, I'm just so happy to see 70 years later that these things are still working. Things just aren't built that way anymore. Construction methods aren't the same. Materials aren't the same. Quality isn't the same. Care isn't the same. Because people don't live with things that long, because there is this desire for more. And when we get it, it isn't enough, and we quickly tire of it, and we throw it away, and we go get something new. That's just the way the world has gone. And so it says, such are the ways of everyone who's greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors. And it absolutely does, because the person ends up burning out in the rat race, grinding their gears every single day just to get more things that they're going to bring in the front door and push out the back door in a couple of years. And at the end of the life, what is to show for it? Other than a long track record of buying and purging and buying and purging and buying and purging, and we give our life to the possessions. And so the warning he gives is beware of that. Especially beware of the ones who will hurt others to get there. And so he says, do not walk in the way of them. In the next section, and we're not going to get there tonight, we'll get there next week, there is a call of wisdom, is how it's titled in my Bible, and he starts to talk about wisdom. And he starts talking about the importance of heeding the advice and the consequences of not. But we will continue that next week. Father, as we close tonight, we begin a journey through one of the most powerful, one of the deepest, one of the most insightful books of the entire Bible. Lord, this is certainly an undertaking that will certainly take longer than maybe others have taken. But it will be good. And it will be rich, and it will be edifying. So, Father, I pray that as we read these things tonight, the the warnings from Solomon, the wisdom that he's imparting into us. I pray that it would land in our hearts in a way that affects us. I pray, Lord, that we would have the wisdom to look at the world the way you do, that we would understand not just the secrets of life, but how to apply them in a way that brings you glory, in a way that furthers the gospel, and in a way that shines a light into the world around us. Lord, there's so many different ways that we can use knowledge. I pray that we would use it well and that we would use it wisely. Lord, would you be with us as we leave here tonight? Would you give us safe travel and gather us again as we continue to study? In Jesus' name, amen. We will see you on Sunday morning. God bless. Have a good night.